I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, the return of J.P. Satilli, otherwise known as the News Vandal. If you haven't subscribed to his newsletter, The Rundown, it is a daily dose of the most important news stories of the day, put together in a manner that JP says will offer readers a meta story, a rundown, if you will, of current events. He joins us on this edition of the program for a very deep and thoughtful discussion of victims and perpetrators in American society. With the chaos that occurred on Capitol Hill last week involving angry Trump supporters, QAnon believers, Oath Keepers, and other elements storming D.C. as our launching off point. The conversation goes quite deep and in many different and varied directions. So, with that in mind, without further ado, my latest conversation with the News Vandal, J.P. Satilli. Welcome back to Parallax Views, the News Vandal, J.P. Satilli, one of our favorite regular guests. J.P., how are you doing? It's been a bit wild lately. We thought we were going to see you having a break from, you know, doing the rundown, maybe a little bit less hectic with having to get out a daily newsletter that is basically a comprehensive rundown of the news of the day. But, yeah, that changed last week, I guess.
It actually has not changed.
Really?
At all. No, I mean, I would like to be doing 55. Since Trump came in office, I've been doing 75. Over the last year, beginning with, because it's really been essentially a year since impeachment, I've been doing 85 and 90 because of the combination of impeachment and COVID, and then came the election, which got me near 100, the 100 mark, and I've been basically going at 100 miles an hour ever since. There was maybe a little gap about 11 or 12 days ago, a little bit of a lull, and it's really interesting. You know, I have a particular audience for the rundown, but I can see what gets clicks and what doesn't get clicks, and there are things that don't get clicks that I keep pushing because that's just the kind of guy I am.
See, I thought there would have been a lull because it felt like the past 2 months there was a little bit of like all quiet on the Western Front going on, calm before the storm, and then January 6th happened. But you're saying that even during the period right after the election, you were still busy as all get out.
Yeah, not for me. And I think it's because I decided I would post this every once in a while at 3:30, 4 in the morning. I would say I'm going to have a hard time stuffing all the crazy in today's rundown. And people would, you know, laugh at that, you know, with laugh emojis, whatever, ha ha ha. But it was true. You know, I'm still struggling to get all the news in that I think should be in there. You know, last week did supercharge it, open the floodgates, but the floodgates have been open, and maybe they've been more open for me than they might be for somebody else, because I have been attentive to the idea that this thing was not over. I've posted that repeatedly on social media for the last 2 months. And every time there was a marker when Arizona certified and then Georgia had, you know, I kept saying it's not over because I go to right wing sources, and I don't just go to the mainstream right wing sources like National Review and the Federalist and I guess Daily Caller. I don't know. Is that main? Yeah, they kind of are.
Is the Federalist mainstream? Damn.
Mainstream conservative, not mainstream. Like in the mainstream of conservative. Like if I was going to clump them together, you have sort of a three-part mainstream for conservative thought outside of the two newspapers. You have the Times and the Examiner. The Washington Times is cuckoo often, and the Washington Examiner is the straight reporting version of a conservative newspaper. Then you have sort of the three-headed mainstream conservative websites, as far as I'm concerned. You have the National Review, the American Conservative, and the Federalist. And the National Review is sort of the old Reaganites. The American Conservative, which was started in part by Pat Buchanan, it was, I guess, going to become the sort of the populist home, but it didn't. It's actually the most reliably interesting and introspective and thoughtful of all the conservative publications you can find on the internet. And so there is a variance of views there. It tends towards anti-war libertarianism in many ways. Daniel Larrison over there has been doing yeoman's work for 4 years on the tragedy of Yemen, for example. And then you have the Federalist, which of the three heads, that's the one that pushes the envelope towards sort of radical Trumpism as far as you can go and still be in the mainstream of conservative thought on the internet. Because then once you get past the Federalist, then you start getting to American greatness, and then beyond American greatness is American Thinker. And American Thinker is sort of a gateway drug to UN's Review, right? So I go past the American Thinker, and I go to places like the Occidental Observer, which I don't recommend for the faint of heart, just to see what's being said. There's another website, NOQ Report, which is run by Q-loving evangelicals. There's a website that I've been using now in the last week on the rundown called We Love Trump, which is pure QAnon, because I want people to see that. I think it provides context for the stories that I'm posting. So as I've been watching that, and because of my background academically, studying and trying to develop a generic model of fascism back in the 90s, my thesis and whatnot, and some academic publishing on that, this has been something that I've been very attuned to. And I noticed about 12 days ago, maybe 16 days ago to about 12 days ago, there was a real lull. People didn't want to click on stories about the crazy that was going on. They were done with the Kraken. They were done with Linwood. They were done with Giuliani. Everybody kind of felt like, now some of the comments I was getting online too were, we need to stop giving this guy oxygen, stop paying attention to Trump. He doesn't matter anymore. We're just feeding the beast. And I was not viewing it that way, because what I was seeing was January 6th. Basically.
Can I comment on that, by the way? I keep hearing this line, and you know, if you disagree with how I view it, then that's fine. But I keep hearing people saying, Trump is this like horrible aberration. He was only able to become president because he was like a reality star and charismatic. We'll never have like another sort of right wing movement like this.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, this has been with us since at least the 1800s. In the sense that I wouldn't say Trumpism is exactly the same as something like the Know Nothing Party, but it's sort of a variation of things like the Know Nothing Party, or in, you know, the 20th century, things like the John Birch Society. I would even say that there's a line between Trumpism and the Tea Party.
Oh, doubtless. Absolutely no doubt.
And I'm not saying they're all the same thing, but they're sort of variants on a theme in a way.
No, it's a consistent beast that's built into the system. And sometimes it's fed, and sometimes it's chained, and sometimes it's caged, and sometimes it runs wild, and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, in the 50s, when it started to run wild, it was captured and put back into a cage after McCarthyism petered out, as much as it did peter out. Because one can make the case that it collapsed a bit, but it didn't completely go away, because it just subsumed itself into what became the new conservative movement with Barry Goldwater that gave way to Ronald Reagan. And those themes were there in the Reagan years. I lived through it. I remember.
Interesting too, because there was always that narrative that, you know, oh, William F. Buckley sort of cut the head off the dragon when it came to the John Birch Society, but they sort of remained in the background, you know, they were still voting Republican. So.
Well, and I think that that's an interesting phenomenon because we have these, we've had these two strains because we also have had, you know, left-wing socialist movements and radical socialist movements in the 20s and populist movements on the left as well. And there was radicalism on the left in the late 60s, Weather Underground, so on. So, I think one of the things that keeps these two strains, and I think the one strain on the right is far stronger than the strain on the left. I think the strain on the left was something that came in no small part with the, waves of immigration that came from Europe, which is one of the reasons why the right became repeatedly active is because of these sort of swarthy Europeans bringing these strange ideas like organizing into labor unions and whatnot. But, and that's always been there, the nativism, sort of merged with that. But, you know, in terms of Trump, I've said this repeatedly that I think he's a culmination. He's not an instigator. He's an avatar and the completion of a phenomenon, not the beginning of a phenomenon, or he's the exemplar of something that's deeply seated inside the American psyche. And I will go all the way back to the Puritans, to early colonial religious thought, which I think is in that, you know, kind of, predestinationist Calvinism. I see all of the seeds of prosperity gospel and modern televangelist evangelical thought. I can draw a straight line between the two things very, very easily. And I don't think it's coincidental that Donald Trump's pastor when he was a young man was Norman Vincent Peale, who was a Protestant who preached the power of positive thinking, which in many ways was sort of an early branded version of the prosperity gospel. So, you know, one of my adages is that Donald Trump has shown that we have a truly representative democracy because I think he's the most representative president we've ever elected. He totally represents what America is in many ways. So I guess that's a long way of saying I agree with you.
Well, I want you to elaborate on that. It sounds like you don't have much faith in the American people.
Well, I think it's hard to. Just from years of observation. And it's funny, I was having this conversation over the weekend with a family member who is torn between two friends. So she has one friend who is both of her friends are evangelicals, Christians. One of them is a pro-Biden evangelical and one of them is a QAnon evangelical. And she's torn between the two of them. And you know, I said, you know, one of the difficulties in terms of looking at the American people, not Trump or Mo Brooks or Giuliani or any of these people we would identify as instigators, at one point do you look at somebody as a victim or a perpetrator? How do we delineate between victims and perpetrators among the American people, among the 70-plus million people who voted for him? So that's a large category. Many of them, I think, many people, many of your listeners would say many of them are probably victims. But there's a point at which you have to delineate between victims and perpetrators. And I think that our desire to be seen as victims when we are perpetrators is one of the things that has fueled a particular form of evangelical Christianity that seems to be organized around absolving oneself of sins without modulating one's behavior towards not sinning anymore. We like that kind of feeling of victimhood and that search for absolution because we don't really like looking at the crimes that have been committed at least in our names. And Vietnam, the Iraq War, which I think is one of the most incredibly corrosive crimes America has committed in the last 100 years. I mean, I think it's one of the maybe the four or five major crimes of American history, along with slavery, genocide of American Indians, Jim Crow, Vietnam, and the Iraq War. And if you look at those five major crimes, how much have we done to come to terms with them? And how much do we feel that we should look at ourselves as perpetrators of those crimes en masse, as a body politic or as a society or a culture? We'd like to find some scapegoats and maybe string them up and have them pay the price for it, which is funny. That's a Christian motif. But, it's very difficult for me to have a lot of faith in a people who I think are reflexively unable to deal with reality. And so this is one of these things, JG, that I think we're all coping with, is what do you do with a group of people who go out into the middle of a street, hold up a coffee mug and say, this is a spoon because the glorious leader told me this is a spoon. And even though you see a mug and they're holding a mug in their hands as you would hold a mug, they're still calling it a spoon. What do you do with that? Where is the point of conversation going to begin to try and come to some kind of consensus on how we're going to govern ourselves when you have people declaring a spoon when they're holding a mug?
I think the thing that really shocked a lot of people, I don't think I was surprised by it, but I kept seeing tweets talking about, I can't believe that there were, you know, seemingly upstanding citizens at the DC breach, like people that had, you know, professional jobs. And one person was telling me they knew one of their lady friends, her ex-boyfriend was a West Point grad, and he was there as part of the mob that breached the Capitol. And I don't know. I just find it interesting that people were surprised at the demographic of the people at DC. I guess in lefty terms, it was sort of like the petty bourgeois, or, you know, like a lower middle class type thing,
as opposed to the lumpen proletariat. And,
yeah. I don't want to get too bogged down in terms, but I'm saying is it was different than what a lot of people expected.
Well, and now former military, active duty military, former police officers, active police officers involved. And the insanity, the video that as we're coming on, we're taping this today, the morning's video that made the rounds and shocked everybody was a Capitol police officer being grabbed and pulled off of the sort of the defensive position he was in, and then being beaten with an American flag. Is there anything more emblematic of the insanity, right? Of people who brought somebody who you would at least assume, now we can't assume that because there may be real, you know, anti-government types who don't like police officers now ensconced in this what I guess we'll call sort of amorphously this MAGA movement, Stop the Steal movement, maybe is a better way of putting it. But one would assume that most Trump supporters 6 or 8 months ago would have been cheering for a cop beating a Black Lives Matter protester, saying that those Black Lives Matter protesters who wanted to torch a police station deserved to be beaten. And we can't defund the police. We have to respect the police. And then all of a sudden you have an American flag being used to beat a police officer. So we're kind of in like a weird zone now where a lot of things don't seem to make sense. But the one thing that does make sense to me is that we are fully in a fascist moment. We have a fascist movement. It has an ideology that we can define according to its beliefs and its characteristics. And in some sense, I mean, there's a baseline of things that the people who are participating share. And to bring it back around to where we started, it's why my workload hasn't let up, and why a couple weeks ago when I saw the lull both in the traffic on the rundown and on social media with things that I was posting, as I continued to force the issue as I was running the risk of having people say, oh, God, just please stop already. And some people were, as I was pointing out, kind of saying that I wasn't going to let up because I knew it wasn't going to go away. And I could see from the traffic and the tenor of the stories that I was collecting and compiling and stacking on the rundown that this was festering and that the boil was filling quite rapidly. So, I was looking forward to maybe like being done with the rundown at 7 in the morning, you know, after getting up at 3 or 7:30 in the morning, and then maybe doing some exercise, a couple of yoga positions, having something to eat, relaxing for a half an hour, and then getting back to work. Forget it. It is not happening. It's not going to happen. So I would say the word that best describes my state of mind is beleaguered.
Right. I guess I wasn't really wording it well earlier. I guess what I was saying is a lot of people, I guess, were shocked that, oh, some of these people either were or could have been my neighbors.
Sure.
That were in D.C. And I've said to people, I'm like, you know, have you not been paying attention for the past 4 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and not just the past 4 years. You brought up very interesting points earlier about it being about the ways in which the different points at which historically we can find elements of this same, what would you say, collective identity or consciousness in American history and life.
Yeah, I mean, I would even say that there were people pointing it out, people that I'm not even necessarily in complete political co-agreement with, that were pointing this out, even in the 90s. I always tell people they should read that Sidney Blumenthal book, you know, Sidney Blumenthal from the Clinton years, the book he wrote, The Counter-Establishment, because he nailed it. Like, you can call him a Clinton shill all you want. I mean, he kind of did nail it when he was saying, you know, there is a vast right-wing conspiracy. I mean, conspiracy may have been the wrong term. I prefer that term counter-establishment. But there is this vast network. And it includes networks and organizations like the Council for National Policy, the Heritage Foundation. You know, it's a well-oiled machine.
Koch brothers,
the Mercers now, yeah.
Mercers, Scaife, Richard Mellon Scaife. I mean, and this is, I mean, it's you know, that in and of itself is a whole fascinating topic because that gets back to FDR and the New Deal and that group of right wing, I want to say reactionaries, but they were right-wing folks who were reacting to what they felt was FDR selling out his class and his people to this New Deal. And they basically said, a group of them wanted to undo the New Deal. And they had a 70-year project, as it turned out, to do so. And they largely did it. Although, so here's the thing, you say, you know, I'm not hopeful about the American people. The American people don't want to give up Medicaid, Medicare, or Social Security. So as much as the right has been incredibly successful in many, many ways, there still are core elements of the FDR program that are still in place that they don't want to give up on. So, you know, it's hard to know the extent to which these things, the moment that you're in, is the pendulum moving back in reaction or the pendulum being destroyed. Here's an odd, I don't know if I can describe the image, but I have this idea about American history that it's basically a pendulum moving on an axis. So if you have point A, point B, there's your axis, and then you have a pendulum, and the pendulum is moving from point A to point B, point A being the beginning where we started, and point B being the implication is it's a better place. It's a more progressive place from where America started. So more rights for more people, less discrimination, more fairness, that's what you're heading to. The arc of history is bending towards justice on that axis. But the pendulum is swinging back and forth. So there are times when the pendulum is moving forward and we're moving forward on the axis that it feels like you're making really huge amounts of progress very quickly, like gay marriage. And then the pendulum swings back because we have this reactionary impulse in American life to every time progress is made, people get angry and they want to react to it. And then it's moving backwards. So it feels like the whole society on the axis is moving backwards, but it's really just the pendulum reacting to the progress you just made. Don't worry. The pendulum itself is still moving forward on the axis. Does that make sense?
No. I totally get that. Although I would push back in one way. I want to get your take on this.
Sure.
Because, I mean, I get where you're coming from about the American people. At the same time, you know, I feel like there's a lot of manipulation that has gone on. I mean, I always reference the fact that, you know, the John Birch Society, if you look at it, who bankrolled it? It was, you know, Texas right. oil money, like H.L. Hunt. And yet yep. it presents itself as a populist movement. Oh, it's for us, the people. It's led. It's a grassroots movement. And you see that again with this sort of Trumpist moment that we're in, where you have the Mercers pushing it, right? And you have all these moneyed interests pushing it. And there's obviously other moneyed interests pushing against it. But there is a huge, well-oiled propaganda machine. The CNP is so connected to the churches across the country. There's 500, I think, different churches is what Ann Nelson was telling me, that are connected to the Council for National Policy. And, you know, they use the pulpit to push politics.
That's right. So this gets us back to the question, are even the people up on the Capitol, how many of them are perpetrators and how many of them are victims? Because when you start to unpeel that onion and get to the core of who's behind the onion, you start to think, man, this is propaganda. These people are being propagandized. They are being manipulated, controlled, brainwashed, and cajoled, whatever. So it's a difficult question, because then you get into, how do you deal with that? Do you just say, okay, well, we're going to give you this one as a mulligan, and we want you to come back around and maybe stop going to those weird websites, and we're going to shut down Parler so you can't go to Parler anymore. And hopefully it'll strike you to pick up a copy of the New York Times and read the international section and see what's going on in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, once in a while. And maybe you'll expand your horizons and come around. Or do you have to go with, this is the rule of law, we are in an existential moment, these people can no longer be considered victims, they are a perpetrator. It's the Daniel Jonah Goldhagen thing. Back in the 90s when I was studying fascism, put out a book called Hitler's Willing Executioners. Whoa, did that have an impact. That had a huge impact. So this is something that I came up against when I was doing my work on fascism, which was to try and come up with a generic model of fascism that included Japan, because after the war, Edwin Reischauer and SCAP decided that they wanted to frame Japan's imperial period as a non-fascist period, and that was actually just an aberration, to use your term from earlier. They wanted to say that Japan's imperial moment, not fascist moment, it was just an aberration on the way to liberal democracy and free market economics. And so we need to forgive them for this aberration. They're going to come around. And oh, by the way, some of the people who were working in these ministries that were these sort of hand in glove sort of fascist intersections between the military and the business establishment, we need to allow them to come back in, because they're the ones who know how to rebuild Japan anyway. And so we're just going to forgive Japan this sort of fascist moment, and actually not even call it a fascist moment. I asserted that Japan was fascist. And as a matter of fact, there were many Germans in Nazi Germany who would praise Japan for being the most fascist of all the fascist nations, that they had a level of purity in Japanese fascism that the Germans were envious of. So, and for people like Maruyama Masao, who was a sort of a lefty socialist historian who had endured Japan during the fascist period after the war, he wanted to write the history of what happened. but was came up against the reverse course, as it was called by many Japanese historians. The reverse course meaning the progress that was being made to the anti-fascist progress that was being made after the war was reversed, the reverse course of Edwin Reischauer and SCAP. So how did I get down this rabbit hole of me talking about Japanese fascism? So I remember. So Daniel Jonah Goldhagen wrote this book, Hitler's Willing Executioners. And what he was saying is, no, Hitler didn't come along and cast a spell over all the German people, and all the German people were innocent. He actually had a nation of willing executioners who lined up quite readily behind him. And that made a big impact. It's really it's the same issue that was going on.
It's the intentionalist versus the functionalist debate, right?
Right. So there's an amazing book by Milton Mayer called They Thought They Were Free. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I know They Thought They Were Free, yeah.
Yeah. It's getting to this question, like, if, you know, Klaus the baker, you know, how complicit was he in his own crime? And I think it's a really difficult question, particularly when you're in it. This is one of the things that maybe has taxed me more than anything. It was one thing for me to do it as sort of an academic and to study it and to look at it with the space of history. Now, it was just becoming a historical topic because I think you need at least 50 years between the event and the beginning of conducting actual history for it to be history, because anything within 50 years is still journalism. But in doing what I did, which was a historiographical retrospective on the scholarship of fascism after the war, to try and understand how people were assigning blame, who were perpetrators, who were victims, what was fascism, what was not fascism. When you're living it in real time, like we are now, it is an incredibly complicated question.
Well, not only that, but I think it ties into, you know, the age-old sociological question of agency versus structure. You know, how much are you a free agent? How much are you influenced by the structure? And no one has ever been able to untangle it.
No. And I mean, unless you want to go totally Skinnerian and sort of go from the you're just a sort of a biochemical automaton and just make that writ large and say we're all just automatons of the system. But right now, here's a real world example of the conundrum. So Twitter purges Trump, right? They lock him out forever, supposedly. Well, I guess not supposedly. I guess it's locked out forever, because I guess Jack Dorsey, there's no way you can open that thing again. It's just, they said it's permanent, so it's going to be permanent. Fine. Now, there are a couple issues. My first issue is, well, they made their money already. I mean, kind of a safe time to pull the plug after he's had 80 plus million followers for 5 years and generated how many trillions of hits has this guy generated? How much traffic and revenue has this one man generated, not just for Twitter, but for Facebook and social media and for the entire news business and so on? But, you know, now Dorsey can semi-safely say, all right, we're going to stop it. Okay. So there may be a good reason to do that, because there would be more incitement. But we also know, looking at it, I think it's pretty safe to say that Dorsey doing that and Parler being shut down and all of these avenues being shut down is going to do what? It's going to generate blowback. And what it's going to do is the people who have been convinced that they are victims by this propaganda onslaught are going to have their sense of victimhood reinforced by what you're doing. So are you going to punish them as perpetrators? Or are you going to try and rehabilitate them as victims? And how, if short of pulling the plug on what looks to be an emergency, because I do suspect that one of the things that's behind the shutdown of social media is perhaps, I'm spitballing here based on two non-confirmable sources. Both of them came to me secondhand, so I can't say for sure, but it does lead me to suspect that perhaps the FBI talked to social media outlets and said, hey, you know, we have a week of armed protests being planned for the Capitol and around the country in state capitals. Maybe you can shut this down for us now so that we can keep the fire from spreading. But I get that. If that's the case, I understand that. But still, we're at a place at which the more we keep treating Trump's people as perpetrators, the more likely it is that they will continue to perpetrate because their sense of victimhood is reinforced by the way you treat them, which is as a perpetrator. Ruby Ridge comes to mind. And what Ruby Ridge planted, you were talking about, the things that led up to this. The 90s, these kinds of movements have been there, the militia movement, going back into the 80s, really. And my intersection with a lot of this came through white Aryan resistance and punk skinheads, Bay Area skinheads here in the North.
Tom Metzger and that whole crew. Yeah.
Tom Metzger, who, by the way, died about 5 or 6 weeks ago, and nobody paid attention. I did. I didn't post it because there were so many things going on. I was like, yeah, probably a lot of people. And I don't want to go on a long thing about how one of my first research papers was on white Aryan resistance. But Tom Metzger passed away recently, which I thought was a very sort of a weirdly timely thing, because he is in some ways he's the father of the Proud Boys. I mean, if you want to start doing lineage, he's one of its fathers. So,
well, the things that have happened internationally, like the Christchurch shooting, or even here with the Tree of Life shooting. I mean, this is the kind of lone wolf terrorism that Metzger, who, for my listeners that don't know, he was probably the basis for the Stacy Keach character in American History X.
Absolutely.
he was a big proponent of lone wolf terrorism, and that has sort of become what the far right wing in this country and abroad turns to when they feel they're not getting what they want.
And the difference is now is that now the wolves are banding together into a pack. And that's what we saw last week. We saw on the 6th, right? And I think the lone wolf thing is easier to compartmentalize for people. The pack is much different. And so do you go after the leader of the pack? Is the pack now going to be held accountable for it? I mean, I've seen a lot of arrests. So we're going to see what's going to happen in this delineation problem between perpetrator and victim, because a lot of people are going to be treated as perpetrators.
Another good example of this victim perpetrator angle that we're on, by the way, you know, I said earlier, you know, I kind of feel bad for people who are, you know, just getting hammered with like Salem and Bolt Radio every day and going to these churches that have political connections. So it's almost like propagandizing and brainwashing entire, you know, segments of the population. At the same time, you could also make the argument that, oh, maybe the moderate Republicans, the sort of Romney wing of the Republican Party, aren't they victims of this radical base that will basically threaten to withhold votes from them if they are too rhino or Republican in name only, right? And then at the same time, on top of that, you can also look at it and say, well, the Republicans that say, oh, we're being attacked by these radical right-wingers and called rhinos, and we're, you know, just being beaten down by them, people also argue, well, you know, you're complicit. You kind of gave birth to this Frankenstein's monster. I mean, I remember one of Bush's staffers was talking about how when the evangelicals would come to the W. Bush White House, you know, they would talk and whatnot. And then when the evangelicals would leave, everyone in the Bush White House would, you know, make fun of them, right? But in a way, these sort of, you know, moderate or liberal Republicans helped enable a lot of these, you know, Christian right wingers and more far right elements, arguably.
Enable, they weaponized them. I mean, they became a force, a political force that they decided to marry. And that's in some ways that's the story of Reagan's election, which was Jerry Falwell in the 18 months leading up to him being elected, cut basically, in a sense, cut a de facto deal with Reagan to merge the Friedman, Tale of Two Friedmans, Milton and Thomas. Yeah, that could be the American story, A Tale of Two Friedmans, two sides of the neoliberal coin. Milton Friedmanism was married with evangelicalism, and that's what the Reagan Revolution was fueled by, was this marriage. And it's why I've never – I know that Hustler, founder
– Larry Flint.
Larry Flint became sort of affectionately, playfully combative and in a letter writing sort of pen pal relationship with Falwell later in his life, which kind of put a little bit more of a sheen on Falwell. When Falwell died, my obituary about him was Jerry Falwell was a pig, but that's just me. Because of my roots in the charismatic and evangelical church in the '70s, I have a particular antenna for the use and abuse of Christianity for political purposes, not because I'm continue to be a practicing Christian, but because I see the danger and the utter hypocrisy that fuels it, and how dangerous it could become. Because once people start to believe that they are engaged in an existential fight, a binary existential fight, upon that is basically there are two sides. There is the good side and the evil side, and upon your shoulders is the weight of not only the future of mankind, but the wings of God, who will carry you to victory over the evildoers. You can accomplish a lot with those kinds of feelings and emotions.
I was going to say, it's strange because, I think that's why people underestimate these movements, because you look at them and it's like, my God, these people believe that the world is just one big melodrama. It's like some type of 80s action movie, like Red Dawn or something. At the same time, that kind of worldview is also the basis of the mythopoesis of what Umberto Eco called fascism or eternal fascism.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, now we can start getting all Ezra Pound up in this piece now. But this is actually where I've come from with my view of fascism, and why in 2018, my view of Trump and Trumpism changed. So in the lead up to 2018, if people don't follow me, I do a lot of weird stuff for you. That's my journalism is weird. So one of the weird things that I've done is I've live blogged all of Trump's press conferences during COVID, so that you don't have to watch it. I'll do it, and I'll try and sum it up and give you the takeaways.
JP died for your sins.
Yeah, I tried. So the weird thing I did in 2018 was, in the lead up to the off-year election, and off-year elections are usually things for political geeks like me. Most people don't pay attention to it, but in that off-year election, Donald Trump was – I think he was holding at least 5 rallies a week for 9 weeks. Sometimes he was doing 7 rallies a week every day. And he was – I mean, he was out there. So I decided I was going to watch them all. I watched them. I think I maybe missed 2 or 3 of them. And what I saw over the course of those weeks was the development of something that I call – call and response fascism. So this wasn't fascism that, Mussolini, socialist journalist, he changes his worldview and he starts writing, manifestos. This isn't, go to prison, write Mein Kampf, come out with a massive manifesto. This wasn't something that was born out of the mind of somebody who came up with this theoretical system and then convinced people. What I was watching was Donald Trump in conversation with his audience, and since it was almost a rally a day, he could float an idea, and if the idea took off, then the idea would stick, And if the idea didn't take off, eventually Common Core disappeared, right? Nobody gave a damn about Common Core. But I saw this kind of cooperative conversation between him and the audience where they were developing what I think became sort of the fascist core, the nativism, the victimization, the sense of grievance about being sold out by elites and the international community. It's all of the things that are really sort of, a lot of them are classic fascist themes. And that's when I said, I think we may have fascism here. And I think it may be kind of a pure version of fascism, because one thing that fascism lives off of is the consent of the government, of the governed, and popular opinion. Fascism is a popular movement. It's not something that people like to say, because we like to go with sort of the pre-Jonah Goldhagen. You know, there's a demagogue comes and he casts a spell over the people, and the people are like zombies, and they can't help themselves, and then they go to doom, and then all of a sudden somebody comes and rides to the rescue like the American people, and they save the world, save democracy, and everybody wakes up and we live happily ever after. But I think that what fascism does is that it answers a very deeply seated need in human beings to have meaning. It's about the search for meaning, and it answers the search for meaning. So during that time when there was this call and response fascism, I think, being developed in those rallies, that was also around the time that there was a lot of examination of Donald Trump's trade practices and his trade war. And there was I think it was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that interviewed workers at the Harley-Davidson plant in Wisconsin. And farmers were being interviewed too at that time. And farmers were saying, but one guy at this Harley plant said, and I kept the article, I have it on one of my master lists if I ever get around to writing the story of Trump's fascism, said that, you know, I don't care about this economic cost to me. The thing is that we have to do what's right. We have to make America better. And that's one of the things that's, to me, part of the limit of a purely Marxist interpretation or analysis of fascism. I get the Marxist part of it. I get the, you know, big business finds a way of controlling labor unions by creating social cohesion, by eliminating class structure and using, you know, fascist brown shirts or black shirts or in the case of Chiang Kai-shek, blue shirts, they were called, the Guomindang in China, to go and crack down on the communists and the socialists, on labor organizers, and create a good business environment for corporations and for the wealthy. I get all that. But from what I've seen of fascist movements is that there is often a popular upswelling that then later gets co-opted by the big business that often gets blamed for fascism. And that really what you have in there is this need that human beings have to come together and find meaning through group affiliation and through a sense of victimization and empowerment. The victimization feeling, the reason why we're in the situation we're in is because we have been victimized, but together we are powerful enough to vanquish those who are victimizing us, be triumphal over them, and then to create something new and better. It's kind of a revolutionary impulse to overturn the people who they believe are their tormentors and then create a sort of a utopian afterworld, after the world that they are in, a new world, a transformative world in which their identity achieves some kind of psycho-spiritual evolutionary high point. And that is a really difficult thing to battle with tax policy. That's a really difficult thing to battle with any kind of economic policy. And it's why there were farmers saying, no, we got to do what's right. I'm willing to suck it up. Now, later, farmers started to say, this has been going on for a long time. And so Donald Trump put a lot of money around. So money does help. I mean, this is, now we're getting back to, how do you deal with it? Do you punish? Or do you ameliorate with policy? And are there enough policies that you can implement to try and ameliorate the grievances that have been festering, maybe because of bad policy decisions in the past, but I think also because the thing that fascism is getting to is the same thing that religion is getting to. And fascism is a very intoxicating way of dealing with a feeling of hopelessness and meaninglessness and dislocation.
I was going to say, I've always compared it to, you ever seen the movie The Terminator?
Oh, are you kidding? How many? The question is, how many times have you seen the movie Terminator?
There's that line, though. There's that line, right? It can't be bargained with. It can't be reasoned with. It does not feel pity or remorse or fear, and it absolutely will not stop ever. That about sums it up. Like, you know, when you're talking about movements, and people argue over whether it's fascism or proto-fascism. Getting beyond all that, this is why I like the whole fascism idea. When you look at what Eco was describing in those 14 characteristics, he's basically describing this sort of loose sort of fanaticism in which irrationality becomes, above and beyond everything else. You have to believe in the mythopoetic narrative of the hero. You have to believe in things that are completely contradictory, like the enemy being both weak and simultaneously strong at the same time. And it's all in the service of this sort of rebirth of a nation, or what's been called the ultranational palingenesis, right?
Yes.
And it is not based in anything that people who are grounded in an empirical sort of view of reality could possibly understand. It's completely alien to a person like me. I don't get it. I don't understand it, but it is very intoxicating to the people that agree with it. But it exists on a completely different plane than people who look at things, or try to look at things from a more empiricist or rationalist perspective. Not that those things are the be-all end-all, but do you see what I'm getting at? Like,
yeah,
it's not something you can combat. It's based in irrationality and sort of superstition.
Well, and it's capital I idealism of Hegel versus the materialism of Marx. Marx said Hegel was right, but he was standing on his head. He had it the wrong way around, that it's actually the material is the source, not the ideal. And that capital I idealism, it's funny that you're talking about it. It's hard for people coming from an empirical background to unpack it or understand it. It does kind of remind me of Hegel. I kind of have a personal axiom that anybody who says they understand Hegel totally does not understand Hegel. Like, does anybody really ultimately understand Hegel? We can understand like few things, but when you start, Hegel, it's so all consuming, and it's almost spooky on another level. The idea of history as a capital H force, and that there's this zeitgeist or being that's out there that you can tap into, and that it can control things, and there's a spiritualism at its core, and that's one of the things that drives this, what you're calling, what Umberto Eco called Urfascism, that you're talking about, Eco's Urfascism. It's one of the things that I feel that equipped me to understand it was my background in evangelical Christianity, because I could see, particularly with, I grew up in end times evangelicalism. Hal Lindsey, late great Planet Earth. This is before the LaHayes wrote their Apocalypse series, Left Behind. But that is that's sort of the child of the 70s, that series, which I think came out in the early 80s, started in the early 80s. I think it was like 14 books of them. But there's a series of movies on the end times, Thief in the Night. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. You of all people, JG.
I know Thief in the Night.
Okay, I figured you would know Thief in the Night. So, when I was 7 or 8, they brought me into a church on a Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, and they showed me a movie in which, if you were left behind and you didn't get the mark of the beast on your forehead, you'd cut your head off with a guillotine. But if they did that, your spirit would be saved and you'd go to heaven. So it's worth it to get your head cut off by a guillotine, because then you are going to transcend this evil world.
Well, what's interesting to me too is, not to keep going back to Ico, but you can even see one of those characteristics that Ico talks about in some sort of really extreme forms of evangelical thought. And I'm mainly thinking about the whole, the enemy is both strong and weak. Because, you know, oh, Jesus Christ is going to come back and, you know, he'll topple the, satanic cabal. But at the same time, the satanic cabal is like super powerful and super almost powerful. Indestructible.
Absolutely. Because you're always engaged in what they call spiritual warfare. And spiritual warfare is something you're engaged in every moment of every day, all the time. And which is funny because, I mean, once you accept Christ as your Lord and Savior and you've got your golden ticket punched, you get to go into the elevator into the sky, to sort of make a weird little analogy that I think people haven't really made about Roald Dahl. But anyway, because I think that that's actually what Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was about. But so, why would you continue to fight spiritual warfare? Your battle is done. You've accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. You've been rebaptized in front of potentially a congregation, like I was. This is my second baptism. My first baptism was a Catholic baptism.
But the belief systems don't have to be coherent.
They don't have to be. That's the thing, because they're touching on an emotional and psycho-spiritual need that's in there. Now, if we want to get in a sort of 60, 70,000 foot view of this, I think a lot of this, there are two ways of looking at it. This is something that's always been there. We've always had religion and we've always had this impulse, and there have been all kinds of sort of crazy episodes in human history of human beings doing all kinds of strange things because of what they thought was an existential theological imperative. Though that's something that's just a constant in human history. On another level, on the other hand, I think the moment that we are in, and I think what fascism was rooted in, was a response to a 1-2 punch of Marx and Darwin. And in the middle of the 19th century, Marx and Darwin came along and said, "You're all animals, and oh, by the way, you're really nothing more than an aspect of the means of production. You are a purely material animal. There is nothing special, psycho-spiritual or theological about you as a being." And that's why I see rooted in, when I was looking at fascism, one of the things that attracted me to understanding it was the extent to which in Japan there was this elevation of something called state Shinto. So Shintoism became a really interesting, almost sort of a corollary to the Aryan cultic religious themes that were found at the upper echelons of the Nazi Party. And there was this reaction to the idea of evolution, and particularly in Nazism and in the Aryan man mythologies. If you think about it, really what they're doing is they're taking the idea of man as being this evolutionary creature, and they're making it a theological principle. Because the more that Aryan blood is concentrated in future generations of Germans, the Aryan Superman will emerge. Because all you have to do is get more and more Aryan blood together in one individual person, and eventually you'll get that individual Superman. And it's taking the process of evolution and it's adding a theological element to evolution. That's what I believe. And I think the same thing was happening with state Shinto. And the reason why I think fascism did not take root in the same kind of with the same kind of zealous effect in Italy is because there were competing forms of meaning in Italian life. And the idea of the new man and new Rome that Mussolini was peddling was not nearly as intoxicating as attractive to the average Italian, because the average Italian was already living in a bifurcated society where the people in the North and people in the South saw them as almost two different races. And often the people of the Mezzogiorno were looked down upon by the people of the North. And there was a lot of particularism. And plus you had the Catholic Church there as a source of potential meaning for people that people were already rooted in.
It's funny you mention that, because I remember when I had Alexander Ceylon talking about Silvio Berlusconi. Yeah. He said to me, Berlusconi ruined everything because the two churches were defeated under Berlusconi. And I said, what are the two churches? And he said the Catholic Church and the Italian Communist Party.
Yeah.
Yeah, because those were places that people found meaning, you know.
Yes. Yes. And it's so funny that you bring up the Italian Communist Party, because, you know, if you look at communism, such as it is, in Central and South America in the late 70s and in the 80s, it was often intersectional with the Catholic Church and liberation theology. And the same thing was true in Italian life. Communism was not seen as something that was going to eliminate the church. It was rooted in the Book of Matthew and the idea of sort of the governing principles of the Catholic Church. So, boy, we're going far afield, as we often do, JG.
Well, it's interesting because you're sort of hitting on something in talking about the sort of mythopoetic nature of fascism and how it gives meaning, or it fills a void of meaning. It sort of explains why I always tell people, socially, I believe that there's meaning in, you know, social existence and our social relationships. But on like a purely cosmic level, I've always told people I'm a nihilist. And they're always like, why would you be a cosmological nihilist? And I always would say to people, because the people who believe there's like some grand meaning to the universe, they're the fanatics that will probably like kill me for not worshiping the right God. But it's like I have the opposite reaction that the person who fills that void of meaning and turns to fascism has. I'm like, oh, back away from the true believer, you know, whereas I think a lot of people go towards it because it does fill that void.
Say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, at least it's an ethos,
right?
Walter from
The Big Lebowski.
Right? When they face the nihilists, say what you will. It tells you what a history nerd I am. To me, that's the funniest line of the whole movie. I mean, that stuck with me. It's just so funny. Say what you will.
I keep thinking of, and we're going afield, but, and I promise to wrap it up in a bit here, but I keep thinking about, I'll use this as the example. Carl Sagan in the Pale Blue Dot video. You ever seen that?
No, I haven't seen that.
So it's Carl Sagan. What was that? What was the show he had called? Cosmos.
Cosmos.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Where he's talking about, if you were to look at Earth from like the vastness of the universe, you would just see a pale blue dot.
Oh, yes. You know? Yes.
And he's saying like all the empires and all the wars, all of it won't matter because we're just a pale blue dot. And I've known people when I've watched that video with them, they would cry and feel like really horrible about it. It made them feel like, oh, life's meaningless. And I would watch it and be like, wow, that's like, that is a real relief. I guess I don't have to worry so much.
It's liberating. It's
right,
liberating.
Right.
Yes. Well, look, I'm kind of with you. I'm not one that's interested in finding some kind of psycho-spiritual transcendence through my association with a group of thugs. But I do think I get it. And it's why I didn't let up on my workload. And why I did tell people, you know, 12 to 13 days ago, I said, I know you're getting tired, but I think this is important. And, you know, to get back to how you deal with it, even though I think that the pure materialist interpretation, or the Marxist interpretation of fascism, often fails to address this mythopoetic need that is being met. The one thing that does seem to have – the one thing that is a possible salve is to make people economically comfortable. And I think maybe the reason why McCarthyism petered out in the 1950s was because a lot of people were living pretty good lives. And particularly after the Great Depression, after World War II and the sacrifices many people made in World War II, you know, not even having sugar for days or whatever, all the sacrifices that this generation made collectively together that bound them together, those sacrifices were made whole by the amazing economy of the 1950s. Now, I understand that many parts of society did not participate in that amazing economy, but the people that did, I mean, that was the largest middle class ever created in the history of mankind, with the largest, with the greatest distribution of wealth mankind has probably ever achieved. I mean, a lot of people were participating, and then going from having nothing to having a fully electric kitchen with dishwashers and stuff. It was like incredible. And so that kind of economic security, which I would say is rooted in no small part in a kind of Keynesian approach to an economy, which is a demand side economy as opposed to a supply side economic system, does sort of modulate the power of the appeal of fascism. And the problem is getting there once fascism is let out, right? Once the beast is loose, how much of your energy can you spend towards trying to fix the economy when you're trying to keep the body politic from bleeding out? And, you know, will a $2.5 to $3 trillion infrastructure program over the next 4 years put this monster back in a cage? I don't know. I think it's probably one of the only things that can be done at all. It's like one of the only tools available in the toolbox, even though it's not even guaranteed to work. But, you know, the times when American life seems to be I don't even want to say that, because let's just look back at what we've been doing. We've pretty much been at war killing each other or somebody else now for most of our history. And so to get back to one of the original foundations of this long meandering conversation, thanks in no small part to my meandering, I am skeptical of where we are as a polity and as a population because of our inability to deal with our fundamental sins. And because we are not, we just blew by Iraq. I mean, it's like Iraq never happened. We, the United States of America, took a country that did not threaten the United States of America, did not attack the United States in America, in no way, shape, or form was likely to threaten the United States of America anytime in the next 10 or 15 years, and destroyed it and killed tens of thousands of people. And we just walked away like it didn't happen. That is sociopathic. And I think that one of the things that we are still coping with and dealing with is that not only have we not dealt with the crimes of our that date back to the founding of the United States, we haven't dealt with the crimes that dealt with trying to deal with the fallout of the Civil War, which led to Jim Crow. We haven't dealt with those crimes either. As I look at this stark division, the people who were storming the Capitol and the people who were standing back going, what are these people thinking? In some really indelible way, I think we are still dealing with Vietnam. And if you want to talk about mythopoetic, isn't there something incredibly poetic about the man who's running the country being a guy who got out of going to Vietnam and turned most likely to General John Kelly, who I think is the guy who said it to, and said, who are these suckers who went to Vietnam, didn't realize who were too stupid to get out of going to Vietnam? I wasn't too stupid to go to Vietnam. Why would I go die in a war like that? But that division, that cultural division of Vietnam, and the fact that we never processed the crimes committed in Vietnam, where between 3 and 5 million people died in Indochina. So you take Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. 3 to 5 million people. I used to go to the Vietnam War Memorial. It was my favorite memorial to go to. And I don't mean favorite in a ghoulish way, but just because emotionally, it's just I've never been impacted by a piece of memorial art like I am affected by the Vietnam Memorial. When you start walking, and it's almost like you're walking into a pool of death, a black pool of death. You start with your head above water with the first deaths. And then when you get to the moment of the greatest amount of death, you are basically underwater in a pool of black death. And it's just the pool is made up of names. Then you come out the other side. Every time I would go, that would bring me to tears. And every time I walked out and came out the pool the other side, I thought, where's the memorial to the 3.5 million Vietnamese or the 5 million Indochinese who died? We don't have that memorial. We don't like to think about that. We don't want to process that. In the 70s, I think we were processing that in popular culture. We were getting to the deer hunter. And even into the 80s, we got to Platoon. But what was the 80s all about? It was all about Rambo and Chuck Norris and missing in action and forgetting about Vietnam and doubling down. And what did we do in Iraq? We replicated the Vietnam moral error again. And I just think that this is a country, whether people are perpetrators or victims, I know it's a complicated question, but ultimately, if we keep committing the same crime over again and walking away from responsibility, we are all perpetrators.
We're all complicit, in other words.
All complicit.
So I think that's a perfect note to wrap up on. The only thing I would add, I do think there's one more salve, and I just want to bounce this off you and get your thought on it. I think that a lot of people have never contended with Max Weber and his work on the Protestant spirit and capitalism. Absolutely. And the Iron Cage. And I think that we're increasingly living in a society where capital creates literal space. I always use the example of Citizen Kane. The richer he gets, the farther and farther he gets away from people, which is what happens in real life. The richer you get, you do get more and more isolated. And I think we live in a society where people feel really isolated. I think people that, you know, live in, you know, suburbs don't know what people living in the cities go through. People in rural areas don't know what the people in the cities go through or the suburbs. And I think people are really isolated. And in a way, that's why I mentioned the social meaning thing, you know, because I'm not a nihilist when it comes to social meaning. I think, you know, I mean, I'm for experiments in like mixed income housing, for example. I think if people lived together, they would see each other as being more human. And maybe that's the problem. Like, we're just so disconnected from one another. Not to sound like too much of a hippie. I'm not going to start singing Kumbaya.
How about eliminating the monetized filters through which we interact with one another, like social media, where we have the illusion, the little dopamine hit of, oh yeah, you're still interacting with people, but you're not really interacting with people like you would if you lived in a neighborhood where you actually saw your neighbor and then went up and face-to-face talked to your neighbor. You're doing it through managed bubbles, managed by algorithms that have all been modulated to try and create the greatest value for the people controlling the filter.
And it's not like we're saying like, oh, we all have to become like Pennsylvania Dutch Amish. I'm not dissing that either. I've been to central Pennsylvania. It's interesting, but we've gone so far in the other direction now where we're just plugged into the matrix.
Well, and this is, I mean, I can, we, maybe we'll do this down the road. Weber and Roger Taney was the other scholar who followed up on Weber. I absolutely. Yeah, you'll remember at the beginning of this conversation, I mentioned that I could draw a straight line between Donald Trump and his evangelical base and the Calvinist Puritans who were the first colonists to come to the United States, because what they believed was in the signs of election, that, well, there's nothing you can do through works to ensure your salvation. God, Alpha, the Omega, he has decided whether or not you're going to heaven or hell. But how do we know if Brother Johnson over there is going to heaven or hell? Well, I've noticed that Brother Johnson's crops have not been doing well for the last two seasons, and his family is struggling, and one of his children died at birth. I don't think Brother Johnson is showing the signs of election. He's obviously not going to heaven. Whereas Brother Smith over there, he has this thriving shipbuilding business. Now, the ships are bringing slaves in on the Iron Triangle, coming to the New World. But they're doing really well. And I saw that his daughter married, Brother Horkheimer's son, who is very wealthy, and the whole family is doing well. Obviously, Brother Smith is showing the signs of election. Obviously, he is going to heaven. And I think that this is, this is something that Weber, nobody has really done the analysis that Weber has done and been as overlooked as Weber has been. I mean, I think he's maybe the most sadly overlooked scholar of the last 200 or 300 years. And the importance of Weber's work to me is monumental. And in terms of understanding the intersection of American Protestantism and capitalism, and why we have what we have, and why we would elect a man who, I think, if I was going to analyze him as one kind of thing, I would call him a televangelist. He's a televangelist. And I do not think any of that is coincidental at all.
Who was the guy you mentioned at the beginning? I've heard of him before. The positive thoughts guy that influenced Trump.
Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking.
And that tells you everything you need to know about Trump. If anyone can get a copy of that book, they should read it. It will give you an insight into how Trump operates.
Yeah, because you just create your own world. You create your own reality. It's and I think Norman Vincent Peale is a very Max Weberian inheritor of those early Puritans who are looking for the signs of election all around them.
Well, we'll leave it at that. We're going to have to talk about Weber on the next episode, though. How can my listeners, by the way, read The Rundown, which is a very valuable resource?
Yeah, so The Rundown, go to newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com. A little box will pop up. You sign up. The first time you see it, you're going to go, what? You're going to say, he wants me to read all that? No. I take the headlines. I never rewrite a headline. I take the headlines as they are written by the news outlets. I stack them together. So what you do is you read the headlines in order, and that's what I call the meta story of the day. And then if you want to pursue any of the links that are appealing to you, you go through them. But I recommend reading the headline from beginning to end. Just read the headlines in order, and then you can make your selections after that. That'll take you – reading the headlines in order will probably take you about – 5 to 8, maybe 10 minutes, depending on how you read. And it'll come to you Monday through Friday. Try to get it out as early as possible. And then if you want, you can follow me on Twitter at NewsVandal, or you can go to my Facebook page where I try to live blog as much of reality as I possibly can.
Well, thank you again, JP Satilli, the News Vandal, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for indulging me yet again, JG.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with JP Satilli, the News Vandal. We always tend to have a very, very in-depth discussion when JP is on the show, and I hope that you found it very enlightening. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of the program by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Nathan, Holland, Chase, Zach, Ted, Grass, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, then consider joining those listeners in supporting me financially at my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. At the $10 or $15 tiers, there is also, of course, the $1 and $5 tiers. Any support financially from you, the listener, is welcome and will keep this show going. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.